Hello and welcome to this discussion episode, and today we are looking at Edward II by Christopher Marlowe, and we're going to be looking at a new book that is coming out shortly on the reputation of Edward II, 1305 to 1697, A Literary Transformation of History. In fact, I'm lucky to have the author with me today. So do introduce yourself to our dear listeners.
Hello, everyone. My name's Kit Hayam, and I'm a lecturer in English at Northumbria University, and really excited to be here to chat about Edward II.
So we are here to talk about the troublesome reign and lamentable death of Edward II, Christopher Marlowe's play. I believe I got a dating, though I never trust any dating, of around 1592, a year or so before he has an unfortunate cutlery incident. So for the newbie listener at home, tell us just a little bit about the play itself, a little bit about Marlowe, just to give anyone who's never heard of the play just a taste of what is it?
So Edward II, as you say, written probably around 1591, 1592-ish, is the story of a 14th century English king who's absolutely terrible at being a king in various ways. Most problematically, this includes, in the context of the play, promoting his favourites, who are also his sexual and romantic partners, to important positions which they are neither qualified enough nor nice enough people to really be able to do. This ends very badly for him. The country descends into civil war. His first favourite is beheaded by his nobles. He adopts some other favourites, which also doesn't go very well. Eventually, his wife, who is French, escapes over to France and invades the country in order to get rid of him. He's deposed and kicked off the throne in favour of his son. And he is then murdered in a fairly gruesome fashion, which perhaps we will be talking about a little bit more later on.
Yes, so Marlowe writes this play. He's basing it on a number of sources, and your book is, titled A Literary Transformation of History. So shall we start with where this story starts in the earliest accounts? Is that a good place to start, do you think? And how does that change over time?
Yeah, so I suppose my book, at its simplest, is the story of how we got from Edward II's lifetime to the 16th and 17th century, by which there's a consensus that he was definitely in sexual and romantic relationships with his male favourites, and he was definitely murdered in this gruesome fashion, which is by anal penetration with a red-hot spit. And by the way, I will die on a hill to say red hot spit, not red hot poker, because all the early modern sources say spit, not poker. But we all say red hot poker in kind of modern parlance now, but it's a spit. So yeah, the book is the story of that process of consensus building. Because within Edward II's lifetime, we have a couple of texts published which are saying he was sexually transgressive in some way. That's as far as they go. And then the earliest accounts of his murder, well, some of them don't even say it's murder. They just say the king died, because that's a pretty politically sensitive thing to be talking about. Those that do say it was murder are very, very circumspect about exactly what happened. And the earliest account of the murder in the red hot spit / poker fashion isn't written until a text that comes about sometime between 1333 and 1347. So there's no contemporary sources for that murder method. And so when we're telling the story of how those two consensuses were built up, which are really the two things that most people kind of think they know about Edward II today, that he was involved in relationships with men and that he was murdered in this horrible way. That story is something that Marlowe's Edward II plays a really, really significant part in, alongside various other literary texts and chronicle sources. And so the book is kind of about rethinking the relationship between those things as well.
So, yeah, so that relationship changes with the play as well as before the play as well. What do you think, what's Marlowe doing with these sources? That is perhaps a better question to ask.
I mean, a few really interesting things, I think. The first thing to really emphasise, and one of the reasons that Marlowe plays such like a significant role in this story of the formation of Edward II's reputation, is that Marlowe's Edward II is the first text that unambiguously presents Edward as being in a sexual and a romantic relationship with his favourites. And I am going to keep stressing sexual and romantic, because I think we all sort of know that the story of Edward II is a story of sexual transgression. But if you look at the texts that are written in the early modern period, it is also very, very much a love story. Like, it's something that you're supposed to emotionally engage with, as well as kind of be sensationally shocked by at different points. So before Marlowe, the chronicle sources that he's building on, they're saying things like, well, Edward II was very sexually transgressive, and his favourites were definitely encouraging him to do that, and he wouldn't have done it if it hadn't been for his favourites. But they're not joining the dots. They're never saying what Edward II was doing that was sexually transgressive was specifically having sex with his male favourites. And Marlowe is the first text to actually take those hints and bring them into explicitness. And I think, like, the fact that he's a dramatist is one of the things that gives him real freedom to be able to do that, because drama is allowing him to present history kind of through narration in the mouths of fictional characters, rather than through a kind of authorial voice that is saying these scandalous and transgressive things to say about a historical figure. And also it enables him to kind of build up a relationship and build up a romantic relationship through the interaction, the dialogue between the characters, rather than having to kind of be the omniscient authorial voice describing that. And one of the main ways in which he really clearly presents that relationship as sexual and romantic is through things like classical allusions. So through using words like Ganymede being the beautiful boy who was abducted by Jupiter to be his cupbearer, but also one of the most specific ways to talk about a man who's having sex with other men in early modern England. And those classical allusions are kind of, they're much more like the stock in trade of the dramatist than they are of the chronicler in this period. And so he's drawing on a kind of established way to talk about these things, that, and all of these things make it easier and more productive for him as a dramatist to join those dots and to present that relationship as sexual and romantic in a way that his sources didn't.
It's interesting, the strange things that do happen to stories when they're turned into drama, and how do you condense that amount of data into a dramatic narrative form? And, you know, when you were talking about, you know, this romantic relationship or romantic relationships that he's having, but also the wider events of the play, which, you know, are various sort of hills, if that makes sense. I'm not sure I'm being very helpful to the listener at home, but there are various events and ups and downs in his life, various elements of rebellion and contention between him and his nobles, but also in his relationships. Obviously, his relationship with Gaveston doesn't go desperately well after his death, and so Marlowe's making clear choices about what to include, what to not include, what to change, and so is there more on that and within the way that the play comes together?
Yeah, I think so. Because I think it's interesting that what Marlowe is doing in making those choices is in many ways continuing the process that his chronicle sources are already going through. Because something I don't think we necessarily acknowledge enough is that chroniclers are also making choices to construct accounts that are going to be enjoyable for their readers, right? They're also thinking about narrative structure, and they're also thinking about what is emotionally compelling and what is sensational, and what is politically relevant to the current moment. And so Marlowe is doing all of those things too. But yeah, I think I would argue that he's continuing that process of making choices in constructing a historical account that actually writers of other genres are also doing. And one of the things that the book is about, as well as the story of Edward II's reputation being constructed, is it's about rethinking what we think of as a literary account of history, what we think of as a literary account, and what we think of as a historical account, really. But I think what Marlowe is doing is he's selecting the elements of his sources which are going to be politically compelling to his audience. Like, this is an age where people are concerned about royal favoritism. They are concerned about the potential for the monarch to be having a sexual relationship with a royal favorite who would then get disproportionate influence. This is something people are just as concerned about in relation to Elizabeth I as they came to be concerned about in relation to James. And actually, Edward II was used as a point of comparison for Elizabeth in loads of cases too. So Mel is drawing on that. And also, the fact that he chooses to we can get into this, but the fact that I think he chooses to present Edward II's murder according to that long-standing story of him being killed by anal penetration with a red-hot spit, that is also a choice that recognises that that's a really expected part of the story of Edward II by the time you get to the late 16th century, even the very, very, very shortest text. If you've got an account of history that's literally a couplet about Edward II, it will have that murder in it. So he's responding as well to what he thinks his audience want and expect out of the story of Edward II, I think.
Yes, the people do want the gruesome and murder. Shall we get it? You've mentioned the red hot spit. Shall we get into it, as it were? Or is it the other way around? The murder itself. So there are various elements that the scene describes to us in terms of the murder: the bed, the table, and the spit. Do you want to talk about, you know, there are questions and how solvable they are about how it would have been staged as opposed to how we would have staged, well, we would stage it because we like these kinds of things.
So there are a lot of, I mean, as you say, I think it would be fair to say that literary critics have not really decided how we think the murder scene would have been staged in Marlowe's period. And that's because we have, like, as listeners will know, like the vast majority of early modern plays, we don't have as many stage directions as we would like. And what happens in the murder scene of Edward II, if you read it according to the stage directions and what's going on in Beach, is that Lightbourne, the murderer, asks for a red hot spit to be got hold of. Then we have a table that's brought in. The murderers are instructed to lay the table down on Edward and to stamp on it, but not hard enough to bruise him. Edward screams very loudly so that they're worried everyone in the surrounding town will wake up, and he dies. And so the spit is like, it's like what Chekhov said about, if you mention a gun in the previous act, you've got to have it used later on.
As opposed to Chekhov's gun, this is Marlowe's spit.
Exactly. So the spit is just something that's kind of brought in and then quietly left on the mantelpiece, as it were, in a Chekhovian sense, and never mentioned again. So if we are to take the text kind of at face value, that's what's going on. Edward is just killed by being crushed with a table, and the spit remains sitting at the side of the stage, being red hot, not doing anything else. What I would argue is that although there's no stage direction that says, and then they stick the spit in Edward, that is actually what is going on. And I'd argue that for lots of reasons, some of them within the text, the fact that the murder method specifically is referred to kind of so often, but also many of them outside the text. And this is where I hope that people who read the book with an interest in Marlowe might find it useful to think about the play in the context of the wider way that people talk about Edward II in this period. Because as I've said, even in the very, very shortest accounts of Edward II's reign, that murder method is still there. And also, the scream, the fact that Edward II dies with this loud scream that will supposedly raise the town around the castle that he's killed in, that is something that's very much associated with that penetrative murder as well. It arises as part of that story. And so we're seeing, I think, recreated in Marlowe's play, the same story as is in his sources. There's just a missing stage direction, as there is within so many plays of this period. And as you might expect, for someone who doesn't necessarily really want to write down, and then they kill Edward by sticking the spit inside him. Kind of gruesome. It's kind of more explicit than you would get in a lot of early modern murder stage directions. Mm. But I think that's absolutely still what's going on.
Yeah. And again, it is, I think, I mean, I've seen it, Edward II, many times. I mean, our listeners at home will, hopefully there should be some show note links to all the various versions you can actually purchase or view at home. There's a couple of audio versions. There's a depending on your region in the world, there are a couple of DVDs as well of varying interpretations. So many murders are available, and so many missing stage directions. Anyone who's been with us for any of our afternoon play readings will know that most of the time we're spending, yeah, and that's where the stage direction should live, because they're either in the wrong place or they're not there. So that's very much strongly by that point part of his narrative, and Marlowe is playing on that rather than, he's not inventing it by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. So as I said before, Edwards dies, unless you believe the people who say that he escaped to Italy disguised as a hermit, which is a historiographical reading, but one that I kind of not sure what exactly the point of that would be. Unless you believe that, Edward dies in 1327. And then the earliest account of this red hot spit murder is in a fab medieval chronicle called the Brute Chronicle, in its Anglo-Norman version, written between sometime between 1333 and 1347. And there's, again, quite a lot of interesting debate, I think, about why that writer would come up with this murder method. Because when we look at that murder method today, it looks like a kind of horrific way of punishing someone for having sex with men, right? Mm. It looks like a kind of sexually mimetic punishment. But I mean, when you look at things like Marlowe's Edward II, as lots of other literary critics have argued as well, it is hard to look at that scene and get the emotional sense that that is some kind of deserved punishment, right? You'd really have to have not engaged with any of the rest of the play emotionally to get that impression. And so when I was writing this book, I wanted to go back to those earliest accounts and like see how the murder was framed in there. And actually in the earliest accounts, the most kind of highly emphasized, the most salient points of that scene are Edward is really scared. Edward experiences a lot of pain as a result of this murder method. And it's an invisible way of killing someone. It's a way of killing someone that's pretty sensational and exciting, but that doesn't leave any outward marks. And what's really interesting is that all of the earliest accounts of the murder, which report this method, they don't just say he was killed with a red hot poker. They give loads of kind of logistical detail, which include, and this is a bit gruesome, apologies, but inserting the spit through like a horn so that you don't get any burn marks on the skin. You've got a kind of funnel. So there's a lot of logistical detail that they're going into to make sure that it's an invisible murder method. And most importantly, I think it's really crucial to remember that that narrative of the red hot poker spit murder, that emerges at a point where the consensus that Edward was sexually transgressive at all is still in its infancy. It's still kind of emerging, let alone any kind of consensus that he was having sex with men. So when we read that murder as being kind of sexually mimetic, what we're really doing is reading back with our own knowledge of the fact that Edward has this queer reputation and applying that to the earlier accounts of the murder in a way that the climate of opinion at the time doesn't really kind of justify, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I mean, around about this, the same time, it's just occurred to me, we've got other kings are available. Other kings being dramatized at the same time by different playwrights. Other plays where there are hints of sexual or romantic relationships with men. I mean, almost exactly the same time we've got Thomas of Woodstock, which hints at a relationship with one of his minions. You mentioned in the notes I've got here the use of the word minion, which I think that play uses as well. And I'm wondering if there's a thing in the air about this explicitly. Thomas of Woodstock, again, is about Richard II, another king who gets murdered. So is there a narrative perhaps being framed around kings that don't succeed as well as other kings? Is there something going on there?
I really think there is something in the air about the word minion in this period, and about the association between the unwise choice of choosing kind of young, fashionable favourites rather than older, wiser favourites who know what they're doing and can help you run your government. The association between that and other kinds of unwise decision, which might include sexual transgression. And particularly, all of these traits are kind of associated with femininity in the early modern imagination. That kind of attraction to trivial things like fashion and physical appearance, and excessive emotionality, which is something we really, really get with Edward II, and also excessive sexual desire. Doesn't have to be excessive sexual desire for men, of course, but just excessive preoccupation with your sexual desire as opposed to with, like, running the country. But what I think is in the air with the word minion in particular is that it comes from French sources. It's been a word in mignon in French that's been used for kind of overmighty royal favorites and or royal favorites that you might be sleeping with since kind of the 15th century, but it's really reached its peak in criticisms of Henri III in France when Marlowe's writing, who's being very virulently accused of having sexual relationships with his favorites, mostly by kind of very angry Catholics. And so Mignon is very much in the air, and anyone who knows what's going on politically in France, and which Marlowe, as we know from the fact he wrote The Massacre at Paris, certainly did, and which his contemporaries and the writer of Thomas of Woodstock will have done as well, they're getting the connotations of that word Mignon. It's an interesting word because it's like at the intersection of the political and the sexual, and it can be used in a very plausibly deniable way to describe royal favourites. So you want to suggest they're maybe sleeping with the monarch, but you don't want to say it explicitly. Very useful in that respect. And I think those writers know, both Marlowe and the writer of Thomas of Woodstock, that if they use the word Mignon, they've got that brilliant plausible deniability, but they've also got that political currency, right? They're signalling that these are characters which may have existed in the 14th century, but they're absolutely bang up to the minute in terms of their contemporary political relevance as well.
Yes, so you were talking about, we may have touched on it earlier, the contemporary political, you know, crossovers that are going on here. And are there explicit, you know, figures at the time that we're talking about here that might be being referenced, or is it more in a general sense?
I mean, I think there's both. And a lot of other people have done some really interesting work on this too, about the way that Edward II's favourites in Marlowe's play, they're very much represented as early modern courtiers of the kind that people in that period love to hate. People who are too young and too irresponsible and too concerned with fashion to be in government. that's absolutely the way that Garriston is characterised. He's wearing early modern fashions. You get this really kind of weirdly specific description of what he's wearing at one point. We're really encouraged, I think, as audience members and as readers, to see Edward II's favourites as parallels for Elizabeth I's favourites, with whom, of course, because they were male, she was being accused of having sexual relationships by her enemies. And then also, of course, it's a play that's about deposition as well as about favourites. That means it's kind of politically dangerous to write, but it also means that Edward II kind of retains that political relevance as, if you want an example of why deposition is good or why it's bad, you can turn to Edward II and you can spin that story kind of in either direction. So he's already someone that politically people have been thinking a lot about when Marlowe writes this play, I think.
Right. Well, we're coming towards the end of our chat, or at least the formal part of the chat. So is there anything that I've missed or any additional thoughts about Edward II that particularly excite you as a work, and also in relation to your book? Is there anything that I haven't prodded enough, as it were?
That's a lovely question. I mean, I think the other thing that I have found really interesting about reading accounts of Edward II and thinking about Marlowe's play in particular is also the way that looking at Marlowe's sources can help us to think about the kind of emotional structure of Edward II as a play, because it's quite an interesting and weird play in that it pulls your sympathies in different directions at different times. Sometimes you're sympathetic towards Edward, sometimes you think actually he's an emotional fool who really needs to be doing something else, and you can see why everybody is antagonized by him and wants to kill him. And those kind of switches of allegiance, if you like, that structure is something that you also find in Marlowe's chronicle sources. And the reason you find it in Marlowe's chronicle sources, like Holinshed's chronicles and Stowe's chronicles and annals in particular, is because what they're doing is strategically selecting different sources for their accounts at different points in Edward II's reign. So when they're writing about the early life of Edward II, they're choosing sources that are really about sensational sexual transgression. But then when they're writing about his later life and his deposition and what happens to him afterwards, how he's kept in prison and mistreated by his keepers, they're choosing sources which are really sympathetic towards Edward II and which are really kind of woe is Edward and introduce all of these details about him basically being tortured in prison. And I think that tells us a couple of things. It tells us that, as I've been kind of banging on about, chronicles are very much literary sources as well. And one of the things I hope people might take away from the book is to kind of rethink the idea that what dramatists do is they take facts and make them into literature. And that's not really what's going on at all. It's much more complicated. So it tells us that the Chronicles are literary sources as well. And it tells us specifically that they're looking for a structure in which would reflect the idea of the Wheel of Fortune, or what we might in literary terms call a decasibus narrative. So the idea that people who are in positions of authority or people in royal positions like Edward II are on a kind of ever-rotating wheel where they might go have an upwards trajectory, and that, but then at some point they will inevitably fall. And when we read accounts where Edward is really kind of reveling in his sexual transgressions and his power, and then he has this sensational fall into kind of abject mistreatment after being deposed, we get that really clear narrative structure. And I think, again, that helps us to see that these chronicle accounts are very much literature, just as much as Marlowe is, and that he's participating in this really kind of complicated process of these literary kind of remakings of Edward II's story, rather than just taking a bunch of facts and making them into something literary and something emotional.
Excellent. Right. Well, your book, The Reputation of Edward II, will be coming out probably sometime slightly after this podcast comes out, or about the same time. This is past Robert talking to the future world. So who's the publisher, and where can they buy these things? There will be links in the show notes, but give us a mini plug for the book in terms of structural gettingness of it.
Great. Okay. So the book, as we say, it's called The Reputation of Edward II, 1305 to 1697, A Literary Transformation of History. It's coming out with Amsterdam University Press, hopefully in October. And it's part of their series, Gendering the Late Medieval and Early Modern World. And as I say, it's hopefully something that will interest people who are interested in Marlowe, but also people who are interested in queer history or political history, or thinking about the relationship between literature and history more broadly.
Excellent. All that remains now is to thank Kit for his time and for talking about his book, and I look forward to reading it, and I hope you do as well. Thank you very much, and goodbye.